Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, you are listening to a Rad Religion Broadcasting premiere podcast. Damn you, Hollywood. And here's your host, Mark Radulich. Yay! Yes, this is another solo jam, no Robert Winfrey tonight. It's just me and my lovely guest, the president and CEO of Honeysuckle Rose Creations, where you can buy all kinds of handmade jewelry. We're at the intersection of geek and chic. Here she is, Alexis Haina. How do you do, madam?
Oh, that's so sweet that you try to make up for the fact that you forgot to let me plug my company in our last review.
I'm in pain and old. Uno.
I do appreciate it. Thank you. And yes, I'm happy to be here.
So we are reviewing The Mitchells versus The Machines, which is how apparently it started off in life. And then it was going to be called Connected when it was going to be in theaters. And then Sony had a fire sale and sold it to Netflix. And it went back to being The Mitchells versus The Machines. It was directed by Mike Rianda, but it was produced by Philip Lord and Christopher Miller. Also Kurt Albrecht, and you should know the Lord Miller guys because they were the ones that got the Solo job and then got fired from Solo for making it too silly. But they are also known for the Lego movies, which despite everything working against them, turned out some pretty funny, some pretty heartwarming movies involving a toy product. So it was a wonder what we were going to get here with The Mitchells versus The Machines. And you and I were talking before the show started tonight that given the tenor of how some of these films go and how this one was looking, I don't think either one of us was expecting this to be as good as it was. What were some of your thoughts going into it?
When you asked me if I wanted to review it, my exact thought process was, well, I am the animation guru for the podcast, so there's that. Oh, and it's free, because I have Netflix. Okay, why not? I'm not out any money. And, yeah, I watched it this morning, and I'm just sitting there going, this is so much better than I ever thought it had a right to be. This is ridiculously good.
Yeah, I watched it with my kids over the weekend. It came out April 30th. I think we watched it that weekend. And we had a really good time watching it. I mean, I think when I had seen, when it was connected and I had seen it, the trailer in the theaters, my wife was like, I bet you're really going to end up liking that one. Because at the heart of the movie, as silly as it seemed, was a father trying to connect with his daughter. And he was like, I bet that's really going to touch you. I bet that's really going to, you're really going to relate to this movie. And I'm like, okay, but you know, Sony animated movies tend to run the gamut of really silly. I mean, these are also the people who put out the Emoji Movie, so let's not get twisted. You know what I mean?
let's face it. Sony has run the gamut between Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and, yeah, the Emoji Movie. They go from groundbreaking, you know, amazing animated films that will define cinema for generations to a movie that is literally represented by a pile of poop. No, yeah. Literally. The shit emoji.
I'm just looking at, like, yeah, they're all over the place here, just kind of going back to even 2006. So, like, Open Season was okay. Surf's Up, nobody really ever talks about. But then you have Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which everyone loved. You have the Smurfs, Arthur Christmas, Pirates, the Band of Misfits. Now, the Hotel Transylvania ones, those were apparently huge hits. Like, I don't think they're very good, but boy, do they sell movie tickets.
Well, I really enjoy them, but that's because they're directed by Genndy Tartakovsky, who I mentioned before on this show is my favorite currently working animator. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was so crazy about that. Not to mention, it kills me to say this, Adam Sandler does a very good Dracula.
He's all right. I mean, like, I found the movies entertaining, but they are also responsible for the second Angry Birds movie, which I thought was hilarious. There's an animated movie, which we're not going to cover because no one wanted to do it, but there's an animated movie on Netflix right now that came out of a China studio called Wish Dragon. They were responsible for that. And they will be, in the near future, we're getting another Hotel Transylvania movie, July 23rd. We're getting a musical by Lin-Manuel Miranda called Vivo. That's coming to Netflix at some point in 2021, and then a second Into the Spider-Verse movie October of next year. So, like, you know, like we've been saying, and we can move on from this. Yes, Sony is all over the map, so you never know quite what you're going to get with them. And with the Mitchells versus the Machines, it was a toss-up with how well this was going to go. So this stars Abby Jacobson, who is Katie, who I was listening to the, Critically Acclaimed, which is William Bibbiani and Whitney Seibold, and they have declared her a gay icon. They just, she was like, queer girls everywhere are going to be marching in step to Kate, to Katie Mitchell.
I could see that. Actually, one of the things, like, I hate to say, I kind of appreciate about it was that, yeah, she's a queer character, but they don't go overboard about it. She's wearing a rainbow badge on her hoodie, and at the end, her mom asks if she's bringing her girlfriend home for Thanksgiving. And yeah, I like the subtlety of that. It's that she's not a character. She's not a gay character. She's a character who's gay.
Yeah, and that's what I liked about it too. It was, this character is defined by her love of film and her need for her father to understand her. She's also gay, but, you know, we're all also something. You know what I mean? Like, there's a thing that is at the heart of us that drives us, but then we're other things too. It's like Bubble said in The Wire. He's like, there's no harm in grief, but you have to make room for other things. Mark that on your bingo card. That's my Wire reference for the show. and then opposite her is Danny McBride as Rick Mitchell, her dad, Maya Rudolph, who's getting a ton of voice work. Mike Riendis, Aaron Mitchell, who my daughter said reminded her of Jonas. Though Jonas has never opened up a phone book and, like, gone through it one by one asking if anyone wanted to talk about dinosaurs to him. However, he will engage you in a conversation about video games, whether you like it or not. He's been known to do that.
Aaron was he stole the show for me. Again, it's like, you don't think that this is the character you're going to identify with. You watch the trailers and you think it's the annoying little brother who's kind of quirky because they couldn't write a character for him. No, this is a very well-defined child character. And it's even more hilarious that he's voiced by the guy who wrote and directed the movie. And we just love him. You know, I was like, okay, which celebrity comedian did they get to voice this actor? Oh my God, this is a guy who's never done any voiceover work in his life. And he's hilarious.
And we have Olivia Colman, who's the fucking queen, by the way. She's the fucking queen.
She's literally.
She's on the crown. She's the queen. Or she was for the last two seasons. And she's the PAL virtual assistant, and she is the villain of this thing. You have Eric Andre, who, if you know nothing else about Eric Andre, he's the guy in the meme shooting the guy in the chair that's always like, why did you make me do that? There's Fred Armisen as the Debrobot 5000, Beck Bennett, who plays another one of the broken robots. Chrissy Teigen as Haley Posey, who's one of the
perfect
neighbors.
And her husband, John Legend.
Okay,
that actually kind of killed me a little bit, because on one hand, you look and go, oh, pointless celebrity cameos. Here's the thing. The Poseys are, they're seen as sort of a rival to the Mitchells, but it's because they are seen as the perfect family. You know, they are flawless on Instagram. They always seem to be just doing everything wonderfully. If you've ever seen anything from Chrissy Teigen and John Legend on Instagram or Twitter, that's them. This is like the flawless celebrity couple. They're always posting pictures with their kids, and Chrissy's always talking about how she bonds so well with them and all the activities she does with them. And it's freaking hilarious. So it's like, there is a real meta joke in casting those two.
Okay. Charlene Yee as Abby Posey, who's their daughter, who ends up having a crush on Aaron. And then rounding out the cast is Blake Griffin, Conan O'Brien, Doug the Pug. And they actually casted a dog to play a dog.
Okay, points deducted. You should have gotten Alan Tudyk.
Sashir Zamata, Ellie Mills, Alex Hirsch, Jay Farrow, and Jay Griffin, and then a handful of others that don't have wiki links. All right, so here we go. Here's the plot of this thing. Katie Mitchell is a quirky, aspiring filmmaker in Kentwood, Michigan, who often clashes with her nature-obsessed and technophobe father, Rick, and has recently been accepted into film school in California. The evening before Katie leaves, Rick accidentally breaks her laptop after fighting over Rick wanting to watch one of Katie's previous short films, and Katie wanting it back, disappointing her as they drift apart. Rick decides to cancel Katie's flight and instead take her along with her mother, Linda, and the younger brother, Aaron, and the family dog, Munchie, on a cross-country trip to her college as one last bonding experience. Meanwhile, technology entrepreneur Mark Bowman declares his highly intelligent AI pal obsolete as he unveils a new line of home robots in her place. In revenge, Pal takes over Mark's company and orders all the robots to capture humans worldwide and launch them into space like you do.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, this is what happens when Siri gets tired of you constantly asking stupid questions, okay? Let's not trigger Skynet so quickly.
Siri, tell me a joke. I'll tell you a fucking joke. How many humans can we shove into space?
Oh, trust me. I still remember when Comer actually used to joke about how he'd do the what does the fox say joke with Siri, and I would look at him and say, you know, when the machine uprising does eventually happen, it's going to be because of jackasses like you that just birded the Siri AI with all these stupid questions until it finally broke.
You know, the funny thing about that is that we have been afraid of the AI taking over human existence and exterminating everyone. I mean, it's a well-worn trope in science fiction that the AI will eventually determine that the human race is useless and needs to go, whether it's Terminator or Ultron or any number of Isaac Asimov books. This is a thing, and yet we continue to go down this path. And I often wonder if anyone experimenting with AI keeps that in mind and goes, no, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. It'll all work out. We need AI. It's perfect.
Yeah, I still love every time somebody posts an article on Facebook about, you know, it's like developments in AI. The response is always, we've seen Terminator. We know how this works out. Abort!
I think my favorite my favorite AI sex robot computer type story that's come out over the last couple of years has been that they developed an AI to write something, and it immediately became racist.
I do love all the jokes where they say we fed an AI like hours of the entire 50 Shades of Grey books, and we told it to write a sequel or something like that. Just like, why do you hate humanity so much?
So anyway, the Mitchells manage to avoid capture at a roadside cafe in Kansas. Rick decides that his family should stay put in the cafe for all their safety, but Katie coerces him to help save the world. They bond with two defective robots, Eric and Debrabot 5000, who tell the Mitchells to use a kill code to shut down Pal and all the robots. The Mitchells make it to a nearby mall to upload the kill code, but Pal orders all the Pal appliances to try and kill them. Katie tries to upload the kill code, but is stopped after a giant Furby pursues the family. What is it? Let the Dark Harvest begin?
Pretty much. Mm. Oh, my God. Okay. You never owned a Furby, I'm assuming. I believe that missed your generation.
Correct.
Okay. Furby was in my generation. I never owned one because I honestly thought they were creepy. But I distinctly remember friends of mine saying that they bought Furbies so they could film them running them over with their cars in the parking lot.
No, I'm from the Teddy Ruxpin generation, where there were intimations that like some Teddy Ruxpins were like possessed by Satan or something, or people would replace the cassette tape in the Teddy Ruxpin with like heavy metal and stuff like that.
I had a Teddy Ruxpin when I was a kid too. My dad would play that stuff for me when I was getting ready for school as a kid.
Nice.
I was a little too young to experience the Teddy Ruxpin possessed by the devil story arc.
On the way to Silicon Valley afterwards, Linda reveals to Katie that she and Rick had originally lived in a cabin in the mountains years ago, as it was his lifelong dream before he gave up on that. Upon arriving in Silicon Valley, the Mitchells disguise themselves as robots and head to Pal Labs at HQ to shut it down. But Pal manipulates them by revealing surveillance footage from the cafe of Katie telling Aaron in secret that she was pretending to have faith in Rick just so he could hear what he wanted to hear. Heartbroken, the Mitchells fail to reach Pal's lair, and Rick and Linda are captured after Pal creates stronger, smarter robots and reprograms Eric and Debrabot into obeying her. Katie, Aaron, and Munchie escape the headquarters and hide from the robots. Katie discovers Rick's recordings of her childhood on her camera, realizing that Rick gave up on his lifelong dream to care for his daughter. Reinvigorated, she and Aaron infiltrate Pal Labs HQ again and use Munchie to cause the robots to malfunction since their programming cannot distinguish him as a dog. Yeah, they do the same. They do this gag a few times where, what is it, a dog, a pig, a loaf of bread?
Dog, pig, loaf of bread system error. Okay, considering how often, I own a corgi, and corgi's favorite nickname is Loaf. I fell off the couch laughing the first time I saw that.
Yeah, I can see that. With help from Mark...
Eddie Loaf, system error.
With help from Mark, Rick and Linda free themselves and plan to upload a home movie of Katie's with munchies in it to short-circuit the robots. However, Rick is outnumbered by the robots when he is about to upload the video. Katie is eventually captured, facing Pal to justify saving humanity. Katie explains that no matter how hard her family struggles, they will always stay connected, dun-dun-dun, despite how different they are. Pal rejects this reasoning and drops Katie from its lair. Eric and Deborahbot have been inspired by Rick's reprogramming to use a computer, revert to their malfunctioning states, and upload Katie's home movie, saving her and helping the rest of the Mitchells. The family bands together to fight the rest of the improved robots, with Linda becoming, you know, warrior, Red Sonja warrior woman or whatever she does.
Oh, I love that line. Mom's scary now.
And Katie destroys Pal by dropping her into a glass of water, freeing all the humans and disabling all the robots except for Eric and Deborahbot. After a few months after the uprising, Katie and her family arrive at her college as she and Rick share one last heartfelt goodbye before she officially goes to college. She later joins them on another road trip with Eric and Deborahbot to Washington, D.C. to accept the Congressional Medal of Honor. All right. To give my tongue a rest, I'm going to go ahead and let you give your craft review. What did you think of the movie?
I love the movie, and there's a couple of different parts I want to talk about. One of my favorite things about this is that this movie is a perfect example of how to do show, don't tell. Early in the movie, we see Katie put a bunch of stuff in a box marked giveaway, among which is a little wooden moose. When the dad is watching the old home movies, we see that he gave her that little moose to calm her down when she was a child and she didn't want to go to camp. So we already know the importance of that, but then later, when they're watching the videos and they see about why they sold the cabin that he built with his own two hands, apparently from scratch, he actually took that moose from the cabin. It was part of the decoration, so we see why it was so important to him and why it was so important when he gave it to her. That is brilliant storytelling. You know, I was so worried that, I mean, obviously when we found out that they got rid of the cabin, we all knew it was going to be because they were going to raise a family. And I was so grateful that that's the avenue they took to explain that. It wasn't just going to be, you know, a speech later about, that's why I gave up the cabin, that's why, because for you and everything. It's like, we don't want that. We don't want it to be explained to us. This was a very creative way of showing it to us. Sorry, my dog just walked downstairs with my husband's t-shirt in her mouth. So sorry, I just lost my train of thought there. But yeah, no, I really enjoy that. The voice acting in this is top-notch. I never would have really picked Danny McBride to do such a good job voice acting, because I'm not going to lie, I'm not a fan of him in acting. He tends to just play characters that are very annoying over and over again.
Yeah, he's a very obnoxious type actor. Like, I've seen him in, like, Vice Principals, and I haven't watched Eastbound and Down, but, he's also on... I can't remember the name of the show, but he's on the new one on HBO where there are a bunch of evangelical preachers, and he's like the same kind of character. So yeah, this one he actually played a sympathetic character you can sympathize and relate to, in a kind of befuddled father.
Yeah, and Danny McBride does have two children of his own, so I think he was able to relate really well to the character in that regards, because you feel a lot of emotion with him. And yeah, Maya Rudolph excels in voice acting. We joked about how bad the Emoji Movie was. She was good in her role as the smile emoticon. I don't remember exactly what the character was called, but even then, it's like, she did her part well. She did what she was told to do, and mm-hmm. she stole the role, and I enjoyed her in that, you know.
Yeah, no, Maya Rudolph is a great actress. She has a look. And she, you know, and she definitely gets more than just voice roles, but I think her voice roles tend to be better than her on-screen roles. And even and she gets a lot of mom roles, I think, also, whether it's voice or on-screen. You know, like, I think she plays, like, Chris Rock's wife, I think, in the Grown Ups movies.
Yeah. Don't have her sing. She played the mom in A Christmas Story, the musical, live
mm-hmm.
a couple of years ago. Not that she wasn't funny in it, but she really couldn't nail those notes when it came to the songs.
Yeah, she's a very good supporting actress. I don't think she's good in the lead in anything, but I think as a supporter, as you know, as part of the from what I've been told, she's good in Bridesmaids.
The scenes when she and Kristen Wiig are just talking to one another, they feed off of each other so well, and it's really good.
Mm-hmm. She's in the Angry Birds movie. She's funny in that. So, like I said, like she's going to be in Luca coming up this year.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a role in whatever this Disenchanted movie coming up is supposed to be. So, yeah, she's a good working actress. I saw her in Wine Country, which I didn't love Wine Country. But again, it's like she's in movies that I might not like the movie, but she's good in them.
Yeah. That again, it's like I said, with the Emoji movie. The problem with those movies is not her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is always good in everything she is. It's not to say that every project she's done is good.
Though I will say, I think the height of her career was Idiocracy.
That was the height of a lot of people's careers. Who are you?
I like money. That's so funny to me. Now is not the time for a blowjob. No, that's not why we're going there. I love Idiocracy. It's one of my favorites. What else?
Listen, I talked about the character Aaron and just how much fun he was. I think actually one of the great things about this movie, you mentioned about how your wife predicted that you were going to relate to this film because of your relationship with your kids. And that's part of what's so good about this movie is that I feel everyone can relate to at least one of the members of the Mitchell family.
Well, I think either you're a parent who is trying to relate to your children and that is a very real thing. You know, like, you know, Pat, I don't even talk about myself. Patton Oswalt talked about, like, trying to get his daughter into Star Wars. And he was like, he showed him to her, and she was like, eh. And then he talked about how the thing that he got into, because it was her thing, was My Little Pony.
And we talked about that on the My Little Pony Meet Transformers source material.
We did. I've actually talked about this before. But that's a constant, like, struggle with parents is, you know, I know for me... You know, I get him to, you know, like last night, the AEW, and there's a review of that also in the archives today, AEW Blood and Guts. You know, my son and I watched the main event cage match together because he likes that sort of thing. But, you know, does he love wrestling? Not particularly. He likes it when it's like over the top, super stupid violent, you know. But, you know, the regular, like, basic kind of Owen Hart versus British Bulldog European title catch-as-catch-can kind of wrestling match. He's not into. He's like, he doesn't find it fun, and he doesn't like boxing. He likes, you know, if I show him a bare knuckle fight, if there's a quick enough knockout, he'll like that because he likes seeing guys get knocked out. But is he into like the sport of kings and the technique of boxing? No, bores into tears. And there's my daughter who likes it when she sees the girls wrestle, but she's not into. You know, I've shown her like women's mixed martial arts, and I've shown her women's boxing, and she's like, meh. I like it when they have fun colored hair and. Really funny outfits and makeup, and they're doing kinds of flips and stuff, and you know, and they're riding it on tanks like Shotzi Blackheart. But once none of that is present, she loses interest too. Meanwhile, you know, the opposite side of that, you know, my kids are like, Dad, anime. Bleh.
Well, they got you into Demon Slayer.
They got me into Demon Slayer because I love my children. You know, and my son always wants to talk to me about the video games that he's playing or the Let's Plays that he's seen, and I do not care. But I don't want to lose a connection to my kids, so I, you know, it's like you love your kids and you care about your kids, so you care about what it is that they're saying, but you don't necessarily care about the thing they're talking about. But,
yeah.
You know, you don't want to lose that connection with them. And that, to me, was at the heart of what The Mitchells versus the Machines was about. And so, you know, you have, and I'll toss back to you in just a second, but, you know, you have... where I was going to with this was, we've all either been Katie, wanting our parents to relate to us, or we're the parent wanting our kids wanting to relate to our children. You as a viewer have been one of these characters at some point in your life. So this is one of those movies where I think everybody can relate to it.
Exactly. Hell, I'm in my 30s, and I try to talk to my parents about the conventions, the Comic-Cons. And the big news with geekiness and what's coming, and all this stuff and everything. And I'm talking to them on the phone, and I can literally hear their eyes rolling into the back of their head.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they don't care. They're not interested in that kind of stuff. So yeah, I don't have kids, but I identify very much with Katie and Aaron. I know what it's like to, you know, be the kid who wants to connect with your parents, but it just you just can't seem to find the common ground.
Yeah. It was very hard for me and my mom to relate to each other. Even today, you know, I have a lot of, as I've talked about, and I don't want to get into a whole thing here, but, you know, I've had a lot of health problems over the last couple of years, and I'm continuing to have to struggle with some difficulties here and there. You know, knock on wood, I'm not as sick as I used to be, but, you know, I'm also not all the way better either. You know, I still have a lot of appointments I have to go to.
And I knocked on wood for you.
Thanks. But that's all my mom ever wants to talk about. It, you know, if she's not gossiping about family members, she, you know, she wants to talk about my health. And I'm like, I don't ever want to talk about this, ever. Like, I always, she's like, why don't you ever want to talk to me? And I'm like, because I don't want to talk about my stupid doctor's appointments. That's why. You know, like, when my dad comes in the room, we'll talk about, by the way, he loved Mortal Kombat and hated Godzilla versus Kong. That was his take. He thought Mortal Kombat was great.
Did he give you a hard time about how we didn't have a positive review again?
No, I don't think he listens anymore because he thinks all my reviews are too negative. But
play this one for him.
Yeah, really. But yeah, he, you know, so like we'll talk about movies, you know, we'll talk about television shows. Like I have always had an easier time relating to my dad. And I think my dad went through the thing that Katie's dad went through with her. Whereas, you know, he's a very outdoorsy guy, and he wanted her to be outdoorsy too and appreciate nature and be a camping girl and all of that. And my dad has, I would not necessarily call him handy, but he has definitely been able to fix a thing or two. Like when we lived in New York and had a basement, he had a whole workbench and he had tools and he showed me how to do some stuff. And I can remember when I was in Cub Scouts, we did a pine wood derby together. You know, and he kind of taught me how to use the saw and things, but did I have an interest in any of that stuff? No, not really. To this day, Jesus Christ, my wife fixed the sink recently, and, you know, Robert Winfrey made fun of me for that, and I'm like, well, I'm an artist. And I don't sully my hands with, you know, manual labor. I am an artist. I am a creator. And I'm being somewhat facetious, but that's a lot of who I am. Like, I'm not really into fixing things. Like, you know, I can kind of hook up a computer in a stereo system, and I can kind of put things back together if they break. But outside of that, like, I don't, like, there are guys who like to work on cars. There are guys who like to build stuff, and I'm not one of those guys. I'm just not. And I think my dad figured that out well enough when I was younger, you know, and he just sort of accepted it. And so, you know, when I related a lot to Rick, because I'm Rick now, but I've seen Rick in my dad. I've seen my dad in the Rick character. And you're absolutely right. You know, the thing with the symbolism of the moose, the wooden moose that was the decoration on the banister going into the house, and he breaks it off because he wanted his daughter to have a good time at camp, you know, and she doesn't know that it's a symbol of what he gave up for her. And you're right. They don't, you know, it was embedded into the movie. It wasn't stated outright. And that made it that much more heartfelt when you get the reveal of what it's supposed to be.
Exactly. I mean, you get the reveal, first of all, of what the moose is in the box when you see him take it out of his car and give it to her. And then you get the extra reveal when he breaks it off the banister.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to lie, I got a little choked up at that scene. It was very emotional.
You know, we haven't talked a lot about Linda. And, you know, we talked about Maya Rudolph's performance. But Linda also is a very relatable character. You know, there are a lot of mothers who kind of find themselves in the middle of various forces in their family. Like, I don't know if your mom did this, and my mom certainly didn't, but I have definitely seen other people's mothers, you know, feel like they are always the ones trying to keep the family together. You know, they are the ones that kind of have to get between the children and the dad, and, you know, it's just like, it's like if mom falls down, everything just sort of goes to pieces. And I think, you know, I think they took great care in crafting the Linda character to where she's not, you know, it's not a bad mom's Mila Kunis situation where she's just fed up with life. She's just kind of, you know, it's more Marge Simpson. You know, she's just sort of hanging on to things, and she's keeping the strands of the family together. And, you know, when push comes to shove, she rises to the occasion, and I really enjoyed that character. It's very easy for that kind of character to get lost in this sort of thing. And they did a great job of making her an equal to Rick and Katie.
Yeah, I'll admit, growing up, I kind of flip-flopped on whether or not I was angering my mother or angering my father. But there were a handful of times where, yeah, my mom had to be the peacekeeper, and I recognize a lot of that. Linda is a really fun character. What actually kind of made me laugh a little bit, and this is, again, something that's developed a little bit more over the time, but it's not said outright in the beginning. You can tell she's an Instagram mom. You know, I mean, the very first scene with her, she's making cupcakes with her daughter's face on it. And, I mean, how many posts have we seen of, I followed this tutorial on Instagram or on YouTube or whatever, and then you look and you go, okay, apparently I missed a step because this looks like an abomination from hell. And then she talks about the posies and all their pictures and how perfect they are. And then you get that line at the end where Mrs. Posey comes in and says, I'm going to follow you on Instagram. She's like, you weren't following me already? That doesn't have to be stated outright, but you really get that idea of her character as it's built over time. And it's really fun. Again, I like that this movie is very subtle with the character development. It's not just in your face, over the top quirkiness.
So I was one of the reasons why I was suspicious that this movie wasn't going to be good was how busy it is. This is a very frenetic and busy movie. They make it work, and it's not kind of an emoji movies kind of a thing where they're just leaning into, we've talked about Tom and Jerry a lot this past year. I've jokingly poked at you because like you and Robert both hated it. And so I've had great fun at bringing it up at certain points. But Tom and Jerry is one of those movies where they leaned into the modernity a lot, and it's going to be one of those movies that just doesn't age well, because you're going to look back on it in a few years like, these are all dated jokes, the music is dated, everything about this movie is dated. This was a snapshot of contemporary culture, and that's it.
Yeah, Jerry is the perfect example of a focus group film.
Yeah,
a movie that you could clearly tell was made by a committee and executive network executives.
Whereas The Mitchells versus the Machine, on the surface, seems also very busy and very, you know, like there's the joke about, you know, my dad is the screaming orangutan, and then they show you that bit from, I guess it's YouTube or something.
I think it was a screaming gibbon monkey. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not gonna lie. I try to follow trends, but I'm not always up on the "this is what's popular right now" in the stupid doesn't matter videos category.
Yeah, I don't pay attention to any of that. But I, where I was going with this was, I feel like the movie made use of contemporary culture without it being a distraction from the movie. You know, the very fact of the matter is, and here we are, you and I are doing a podcast, having a conversation about a movie in contemporary culture. Contemporary culture is very much embedded in people's lives. It's not altogether a weird thing that a movie from the teenager's perspective presented as such would incorporate a lot of elements from contemporary culture and styles, but they don't lean so far into it that it becomes a distraction from the overall narrative. It's there as accents, which is exactly what it should be. And I'll tell you, if I had to pitch this movie to somebody, and I was like, should I watch this? I would tell you, you know, my pitch would be, it's a heartfelt family movie that everyone can relate to and enjoy with a tremendous amount of restraint from the same guys who did the Lego movie commercials. Restraint is, it's so weird because like when you're watching it, and you're especially in the beginning when you're getting Katie's perspective on things, and there's so much movement of the camera and there's a lot happening on screen, you're like, oh my god, this is going to be one of those movies where nothing ever stops. But they do away with that quickly enough, and then they're into the story, and they kind of use it here and there to accentuate a gag, but other than that, it's focused on the story and the characters, which is what a good movie should be. So I really have to give them credit for using an incredible amount of restraint.
Not to mention the gags that they use using that technique, you can actually see how it relates, because it's done in the same style of Katie's movies. This is supposed to be her perspective, kind of how she sees the world, and she sees the world exactly how she films it, with all of the quirky little drawings and the, you know, the cheap special effects and things like that. And I really love, I mean, you get the scene where they're jumping over the car and it pauses with this shot of them. It's like, what was it, the Rick Mitchell experience or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but yeah, the way it's cut and the way it's drawn and everything, it looks like something she would put in one of her movies. And I thought that was so brilliant that they made all of this totally relatable like that. You know, kind of. Did you see the most recent Bridge to Terabithia film?
No.
Okay, good for you. It's not that good.
Okay.
You see, this is where they failed, is that they tried to do something similar where everything takes place through the kids' imaginations, but they keep changing the style. So one time it looks like it's a rough drawing, then it starts looking more CGI, and then it starts looking more fantasy. And it's all over the place, and it's just really not as entertaining because it looks more like they're just having fun with the effects. You don't really get a grasp of why the kids would see things the way they do. This, you understand exactly where they're coming from with the gags and with those extra little illustrations. And I think it really pays off.
What did you think of the single from the movie On My Way by Alex Leahy?
Wait, wasn't that song also in Shrek?
I don't think so. I think this was a new song.
Possibly. I hate to say it. I'm kind of lousy at remembering song titles, especially since, let's face it, a lot of times a song title doesn't actually relate to any of the song lyrics. So sometimes I'm like, wait, did they actually mention that in the song? So I may be forgetting which song it is, but I'm sure there's, you know, some kind of technology that can help me with that.
Absolutely. If you're having trouble remembering On My Way by Alex Leahy, which is a brand new original song for the soundtrack of The Mitchells vs. The Machines, you can click the link in the description that says getamazonmusic.com/W2M, and you get yourself a free 30 days of Amazon Music for free. And then you can go and check it out. It's actually streaming there. The soundtrack included all kinds of different artists like Lus, Campesino, Sigur Rós, Talking Heads, Grimes, Le Tigre, BTS. Ugh.
Okay, I'm just gonna say this. I really don't get the BTS thing, but I'm just gonna sit back and assume next generation, not my generation. This is officially where I draw the line and say old fogey.
People try to put us down. Talking about my generation. That's the Who, children. I asked my daughter when we did the Demon Slayer review, and I was like, hey, Lily, what are you listening to? She's like, oh, well, the K-pop and the J-pop. And I'm like, fucking course you are. We're an American band. Come on, we're an American band. We're coming to your town to help you party down. God, I'm old. The Mai Shi and Median, as well as the aforementioned Alex Leahy. And these are all available, including all of my old fogey bands, up on Cripple Creek. Come on, who wants to listen to The Band with me? You know, take the load off, Fanny. Come on, well, Fanny, take the load off.
That's not The Band. The Band is playing later. Who's on stage?
Stop it.
Well, it fails, quote Animaniacs.
Up on Cripple Creek. She tells me if... Oh, and then you can listen to Alexis Haina's favorite new band, The Fits and the Tantrums. It's also on Amazon Music. So,
Jose, did you listen to The Walker when I sent you the link last night?
I have not had an opportunity to listen to it yet. So anyway, getamazonmusic.com/W2M network for a free 30 days of Amazon Music. All right, anything else about this movie that you want to talk about?
The style is really unique. This is something I've talked about with other films like the Peanuts movie and such, that so many films, you really worry that they're just sort of copying each other or copying what's trending in animation. We talked before about the Cal Arts style of animation, how it's become way, way too rampant in TV animation. That's the kind of style you saw in like Steven Universe and Thundercats Roar, where everything is rounded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my son likes, what's the name of the cartoon? It's very much done in that style. Something green. Not Green Acres, that's something totally different. Never mind, I'll scream it later if I figure out what it is, but there's a Disney Channel cartoon that he really, really likes that's done in like Cal Art style?
Gravity Falls?
Close.
Okay. Because we don't mock gravity. Actually, Alan Hirsch, he mentioned, as one of the backup voices and was the story consultant for this movie. He's the creator of Gravity Falls.
Mm-hmm.
Well, kind of cool. But no, what I liked about this style was it kind of reminded me of like a 80s
Big City Greens.
Huh?
Big City Greens.
Okay, good for you. it reminded me of like a storybook. This was a very stylized animation that... It's interesting because, again, it's 3D, and it's well-done 3D, but this looks like a style that wouldn't be out of place being drawn in a kid's book.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that it's got... It gives it sort of a... I don't want to say timeless, because this is not a timeless movie, but it really gives it a unique quality that's going to stand out and last longer. And I appreciate how well they made it work.
I would agree. All right. I would highly recommend this movie. Sounds like you would recommend it, too. There's no money to talk about or anything. You know, it had a $50 to $100 million budget, and I think they sold it for $110 million. So, you know, they just made a small profit off of this. And, you know, that's always the Faustian bargain when you decide to sell to a streamer. You can either sell it for what you know you'll make a tiny profit on and just move on and do something else, or you take the chance that, you know, like releasing Croods into theaters, the Croods 2, you know, that maybe it'll be successful and, you know, maybe it'll take advantage of the current film situation, movie situation, or it won't and it'll bomb. You know, you never know what's going to happen. And I think Sony was just hedging its bets, and it's like, you know what? We'll take the sure thing, and you know, and we'll worry about putting movies in theaters next year. So,
let's face it, the investors for Croods 2 are probably the only people who are praising the pandemic.
But Sony has Peter Rabbit 2 coming out this summer, so you know, maybe they'll make a tidy profit off of that. You know, we're starting to see a return to theaters despite it all. So, you know, I think it's, you know, like everything else, it's a mixed bag, and you never know, you know, what a film studio is going to do per film. Sometimes it's like, you know, yeah, this one will sell, this one will keep in theaters, this one will put off for another year. You never know. So with that said, let's talk about some news.
And now, a Muppet News Flash!
All right, our first story here comes from The Hollywood Reporter. It was printed May 5th. Behind Warner Brothers' search for a black Superman. This has been going on for a while now. There were rumors of Michael B. Jordan being black Superman months ago. And now there was some Twitter kick-up when the story started to come out yesterday or the day before. After enlisting Ta-Nehisi Coates to write the latest feature on the superhero, the studio is searching for its director and star as it kickstarts the next phase of the DC Universe. While promoting the Amazon Prime film Tom Clancy's Without Remorse, which apparently sucked diddly yucks, in late April, Michael B. Jordan put a kryptonite pin in any rumors that he might suit up as Warner Brothers' next Superman. "I'm flattered that people have me in the conversation," Jordan told The Hollywood Reporter. "It's definitely a compliment, but I'm just watching on this one." With that, a whole new guessing game is kicked off, centered who will play the Man of Steel, and arguably more pressing, who will direct. Sources say J.J. Abrams, who is producing the film, is not among the many possibilities being considered. When Warner's announced in February that celebrated author Ta-Nehisi Coates is writing the screenplay and Abrams is producing, it did not address the matter of helming. But insiders say Warner's and DC are committed to hiring a black director to tackle what will be the first cinematic incarnation of Superman featuring a black actor, with one source adding that putting Abrams at the helm would be tone-deaf. I kind of agree with that. In a fitting twist, the director search is pitting DC against none other than Marvel, as Warner looks to fill its Superman vacancy. Marvel is on the hunt for a Blade Helmer, and it's coming through the same list. So just kind of skipping ahead here, the former list can include Creed II, Stephen Caple Jr., J.D. Dillard, Regina King, who I think is on the short list, who got rave reviews for her drama One Night in Miami. Someone put on Twitter that they should get Regina King to direct it, and they should have the guy who plays Muhammad Ali in One Night in Miami as Superman, which he is quite the looker. He has got quite the body on him, so I would be okay with that. And Shaka King, who is popular at Warner's thanks to the Best Picture Oscar nominee of Judas and the Black Messiah. So you and I kind of talked about this before we started the show, and there's a couple of different controversies that have spawned out of the Black Superman thing. Now, the low-hanging fruit is, you know, why do we have to have a Black Superman when we already have Henry Cavill as Kal-El, you know, Superman? And people have pointed out that there have been other Black Supermans. There's Val Zod, and then there's Calvin Ellis, and these are alternate universe Black Supermen. But then the controversy sort of takes a weird left turn, because people are like, because then Warner Brothers came out and said that this iteration of Black Superman isn't going to be Val Zod and isn't going to be Calvin Ellis and isn't going to be Steel. It's going to be a race-changed Black Kal-El. And that is where I'm going to kick it over to you, because that is apparently what a lot of the Twitter controversy is about.
Yeah. I've been going through a lot of posts. My favorite one so far, it's... Okay, someone wrote, "We're doing a Black Superman." I said, "That's great." Warner Brothers said, "It's Kal-El, though." The guy goes, "Well, what about Val Zod or Calvin Ellis?" And then they have the gif of... oh, my God, what's his name?
The dude from the Guardians of the Galaxy going, "Who?"
Yeah, who? Yeah, exactly. I hate to say it. I can't remember his character's name, and I always massacre the pronunciation of the actor's name.
It's something the Hunter.
Something like that, yeah. He has a very distinct name that begins with a D and a J, and I always massacre, and I'm always embarrassed by it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love this other one. First cinematic Black Superman, and they're making him Kal-El rather than Calvin Ellis or Val Zod. They want to copy Marvel, but they can't even do that right. Racist-ass studio. Yeah, there's a lot of people who are pointing out that this news is following the release of the first teaser for Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings, which is getting a huge amount of following, especially because it is entirely Asian-run. We got an Asian cast, we have an Asian screenwriter, we have an Asian director. We have an Oscar-winning Asian director, I'd like to add.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel like this is not Warner Brothers trying to actually promote diversity, but rather, once again, play catch-up with Marvel. And again, and the other thing is, and yeah, this actually does also piss me off as well, is a lot of people are saying that it makes no sense to do this when there are dozens of Black DC superheroes, many of whom have amazing stories and we would love to see in feature films. Some of the names that were kicked around: Jon Stewart, Static Shock, Bumblebee. There were tons of others, and everyone's just like, "So is there how about a reboot? You mentioned Steel. How about a reboot of Steel, which we tell Shaquille O'Neal, stay away by 100 feet at all times."
You know, you can, I don't think there's anything wrong with them deciding they want to tell the story of a Black Superman, however they're going to do that. But I think, and it's a small detail, but I think it's a bigger deal than all of that. If you have options for already established comic book characters that were Black Supermen, why not use one of them? Like, this seems like really a stupid commitment to the idea of all people know is the Kal-El Superman, so that's all they're going to get. And this, again, it's this we don't care about the comic book fans mentality that they seem to be pushing out. You know, they're like, all the general public knows is the traditional Superman. But we don't want to do a traditional Superman story. We want to turn it on its head and we want to do Black Superman and what that might be like. Okay, I'm with you so far. I don't like the fact that you keep thinking no one can handle, you know, deep cut comic book characters. But here's the thing. The reality is that if you decide we're going to do Val Zod or we're going to do Calvin Ellis, that they really should do just Calvin Ellis, by the way. But if they decide that that's what they wanted to do, there's no reason why you can't educate people on that. You know, when you're doing, you know, give the Calvin Ellis comics to your cast when you finally do cast them and say, hey, go on the talk shows and talk about them. Like, you know, most people don't know about this, but Calvin Ellis, blah, blah, yakety schmackety. And he was in this story and he has these comics and they have this rich history. There, done. You know, people will migrate to an idea if you put it out there and you're talking about it, you know, and you're willing to educate people and people will be willing to listen to you. The idea of nobody knows it, so let's not do it, it one, it's an insult to comic book fans, and it's an insult to your movie-going audience in general, thinking that they're too stupid to accept anything but what's been done for the last 100 years. And that's what aggravates me about this story.
Yeah, not to mention there's also a little bit extra controversy when you look at how people are relating to DC after the Ray Fisher fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this briefly in our review of the Snyder Cut, plug, that Ray Fisher came out saying that he was targeted and felt and basically was kind of pushed around and had most of his scenes cut.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of fingers being pointed at Joss Whedon. There was a lot of fingers being pointed at DC or Warner Brothers. And we even talked about it on the show that it was probably like a 50-50 thing. And a lot of people are on here posting, it's like, oh, okay, so rather than, you know, try to, you know, patch things up and, you know, maybe bring in Ray Fisher for a solo Cyborg movie, you're just going to say, oh, no, we're not racist. We're going to have a black Superman.
Yeah, it. I feel like the people running Warner Brothers, they just, there's nobody there with that really seems to understand this property that they own, and all they seem to do is they look at Marvel and then they look at what they've got and they go do more Marvel stuff instead of kind of looking at what they have and going, how can we best use the things that we have? They just keep wanting to do, you know, just do the same as Marvel. Just do the same as Marvel. That seems to be working. And it's like, yep. Go ahead.
I'll say, it kills me because the best DC movies so far are the ones where, yeah, they completely ignored what Marvel was doing. Shazam, Joker, Aquaman, the first Wonder Woman movie. Those are all, you know, on the spectrum of great to really great. And they were nothing like any other Marvel properties.
I'm wondering how, like, they just tapped this guy, Ta-Nehisi Coates, to write the script, but I'm wondering, you know, how much of the story has actually been developed and if maybe they can course correct now that they've gotten this, backlash to where it's like, okay, well, maybe we should not make this Kal-El, maybe we should, because, I don't think anyone's paying attention to the people on Twitter who were like, why are we doing Black Superman? I don't think that's a voice anyone's paying attention to. The people who are saying, why aren't you doing the already established Black Superman, I think are the ones with the loudest voice and the most coherent point. And I'm wondering if, now that that's happened, and Warner Brothers does pay attention to social media, if they're like, hey, it's still early enough in the game that we can course correct on this. Or if they're going to, you know, double down, because that's the other thing that the Warner Brothers comes across as a very petulant studio, where it's like, we're doing this. Well, we hate it. Well, fine, we're going to do more of it. Like, what are you, Vince McMahon? What's wrong with you? Why don't you listen to us?
It really is annoying because we do need to see more diversity in our comic books and in our superhero movies. No one's going to argue against that.
Right.
We would love to see more heroes being, or more movies being helmed by minorities, by LGBTQ folks. We want to see more of these characters. Hell, we were just talking about Katie Mitchelson and how great she is as a representative of the LGBT community. You know, she's awesome. But we need these to be original characters. We don't need them to be, we don't need characters that are already established to be washed over. It goes back to, I can't remember which podcast we talked about this, but we discussed the, there was a big push a while back to make Steve Rogers and Bucky Barnes a couple, you know, it was like, you know, it's like make them get, or like Finn and Poe from Star Wars, or the hashtag give Elsa a girlfriend thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting there going, it's like, no, yeah, we want to see more characters like that, but we don't want you to rewrite existing characters. That's annoying. And it feels less like you're actually trying to take a stand and steps toward more inclusion of other people, and more like you're just backstepping and saying, okay, fine, I'll rewrite this if it'll make you happy.
It comes across like they're just patronizing the fan base. They're like,
yeah.
So there's this big movement to diversify and have representation, so we'll do that too. And then they don't think about how it's done. It's like, we're not, the vast majority of people that are participating in this conversation are not total dummies. And they know when they're being patronized, and they know that when you say you know, well, here's Black Superman. They're happy. Like, no. You know, what people want isn't Black Superman or White Superman or Yellow Superman or Red Superman. What they want is for you to give a shit about the product and respect the fan base. Respect the property at the very least. And that is something Warner Brothers has yet to be able to do.
And again, I mentioned John Stewart. Fans have been clamoring for a John Stewart Green Lantern film for ages. He's one of the favorite iterations of the character. I think he and Hal Jordan are up there in the top two. We would love to see John Stewart come in. Static Shock was a great popular character. We'd love to see him brought to the big screen, especially considering that as much fun as the Static Shock animated series was, by God, has that thing not aged well.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm a huge fan of the Timberverse animations, but we were talking the other night, it's like, yeah, Batman the Animated Series, that's timeless, Static Shock. They had a guest appearance from one of the lesser-known Backstreet Boys.
Okay. Any more about this? Because I think we covered it.
I think so.
All right. Then let's go ahead and do the final part of our show, the critical review.
Are you ready? No! I said, are you ready?
No, God! No, God, please, no! 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 No!
All right. This portion of our show is brought to you by Grammarly. For you listeners of DMU Hollywood on the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network, brought to you by W2M. Grammarly is offering a free download of the Grammarly software. Grammarly's AI-powered... Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. Grammarly helps you write mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or nearly anywhere else you write on the web. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, spelling mistakes, while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting style improvements. To download Grammarly today, go to getgrammarly.com/W2M Network. Again, that's getgrammarly.com/W2M Network to download Grammarly for free. All right, so there's only a handful of these because this was well-loved by the critics. It's like 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. It also has a very high audience score. But there were a handful of people who didn't like it, so I'll just read those three, let you react to them, and then we'll be done here. Grace Randolph of Beyond the Trailer. Oh, Grace. Grace, you used to be so much fun. What happened? Fantastic and funny moments, but terribly unfocused, which is ironic for a movie about someone wanting to go to film school. Rudolph, Bennett, and Armisen, and Andre do the best work.
I'm pretty sure this was written by somebody with ADD. No, seriously, have you ever noticed that when people complain about a movie saying that it totally lacks focus is all over the place, it's probably because they themselves can't focus on the film itself.
Yeah, I didn't think this was terribly complicated or unfocused. They, you know, you have a family who is, you know, dealing with some internal strife, and in the midst of this is a robot invasion. And then it's save the human race from the robots.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's the movie. It's not that hard. Caitlin Kennedy of Nightmarish Conjuring. Stellar animation isn't enough to save this humdrum family flick from its own bad jokes and bloated runtime.
Bloated runtime? This movie was not that long.
It clocks in at 109 minutes. So just under 2 hours.
That's about the average running time for a decent length animated film. I mean, yeah, a lot of them run to about 90 minutes, but again, that's a difference of less than 20 minutes, so, no, they're right within their window.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's about right for Pixar, or for a Disney studio movie.
Yeah.
Eric Nilsson of The Film Stage. Lacking a precise balance of amiable entertainment and intense thrills, the director and producers fail to rein in violent fantasies that spoil what could have been a heartfelt and clever romp exploring family dysfunction.
What? Okay, this movie is heavy on slapstick, but violent tendencies?
I'm like, it's robots. You know, that's like someone getting upset about the violence in Age of Ultron, where they're just smashing robots, like mannequins.
Yeah, again, there's some decent slapstick, especially, there's a great scene where they're trying to get out of that dinosaur-themed rest stop, and you see them kind of clutching robots and flying around. Mm-hmm. And it's funny as hell. But this is not a violent movie at all.
No. All right, so that's that. That's our, just like I said, there were only three rotten ones, and, you know, I'm not going to run... I'm not going to read a whole bunch of positive ones. We don't need to do this for that long. But yeah, overall, great movie, great time with the kids. You know, there are it's a great way to spend 2 hours with your kids at home watching Netflix. So people should give it a read, give it a watch. This is our second show for today. We reviewed AEW Blood and Guts earlier, like I said, and then tonight. We were going to do it as an on trial, but instead I switched it over to Damn You Hollywood for Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And that will conclude Scott Pilgrim week. We did the books, we did the soundtrack to the video game, we also re-aired our review of Rogue One, the aforementioned Demon Slayer review, Mugen Train, Jesse and I reviewed Pennyworth Season 2, Alexis and I reviewed Looney Tunes Season 1D, plus we re-aired our Brujeria Viva Presidente Trump review. Tomorrow's a re-airing of Days of Future Past, Saturday is the Twilight Saga, and then Sunday is Jessica Jones Season 1. And then the week starts anew. Alexis Haina, Ben Colon, and I will be discussing Truth, Red, White, and Black, which inspired the Isaiah character from Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Chris Bailey and Pat Mullen and I will be reviewing WrestleMania 2. Damn You Hollywood returns with Wrath of Man. Evan Bevins and I are going to talk about Deadpool the Duck. May 12th is the Superblog team-up. We have two joints that we will be submitting, one for Dr. Doolittle and one for Motley Crue's Dr. Feelgood. Plus a review of Weezer's Van Weezer. And then finally, the main event of the week, myself and a whole bunch of other people will gush and praise and say how wonderful Falcon and the Winter Soldier is, and Rob Winfrey will tell you why we're all morons. So look forward to that. All right. I hear you have a company that sells jewelry. You should talk about it.
Yes, Honeysuckle Rose Creations, the intersection of geek and chic, where fashion meets fandom. And big news, ladies and gentlemen, we are back on the road coming this July, Kansas City, Crypticon. We are going to be there. We have a booth. I am so excited. I'm finally going back to work. And we are going to have all of our awesome horror-themed jewelry, including our brand new blood bag-inspired earrings. We cannot wait to see you all there. As always, our stuff is available on Etsy and handmade at Amazon. Also, big note that at the end of this month, we will be doing a week-long sale for Memorial Day weekend. And we will be doing a charity drive for that for the Tiny Homes for Homeless Veterans. This is a charity we've given to in the past. It is such a wonderful foundation. We're so happy to be a part of it. We will be posting more information about that as we get a little bit closer, both about the charity drive and about the charity itself. As always, pay attention to our Facebook, our Instagram, and under duress, our Twitter for all the latest news and posts. Again, Honeysuckle Rose Creations, the intersection of geek and chic.
All right, folks, that wraps it up for this edition of DMU Hollywood. I want to thank Alexis Haina for joining me today to talk about this really fun film. Until then, she's Alexis Haina. I'm Mark Radledge. Be well, be safe, and behave.